Well, hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to our panel on character and business. We've just had a fantastic keynote from Professor Tyer Cohen, thinking about guilt proneness, job performance, and leadership potential. And now we have a terrific panel lined up as well to take on our discussion on character and business. It's indeed my pleasure to introduce the moderator for our panel, who is Dr. Michelle Rehm, who is the interim dean, of the Wake Forest School of Business and the Peter C. Brockway Chair of Strategic Management. She is a leading expert on business communication, branding, and consumer behavior, and has published numerous articles and research papers in a variety of top-tier academic journals. We are delighted that she is moderating this afternoon's panel. Over to you, Dean Rehm.
Thank you, Ed, for that lovely introduction, and thank you to everyone for joining us this afternoon. Hello and good afternoon. We are so pleased you could be with us for the Character and Business panel. I have the absolutely great privilege and pleasure of moderating what I can only imagine will be a very lively discussion with an esteemed set of panelists this afternoon, and I'd like to start things off by just introducing each of them briefly, and we'll go in alphabetical order. So Larry Culp is a business executive who is currently serving as chairman and CEO of the General Electric Company. Larry has also served on the Wake Forest Board of Trustees since 2015. Welcome, Larry. Mary Gentile is a professor of practice at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business and the creator director of Giving Voice to Values, which is a business curriculum for values-driven leadership that has been implemented in over 1,260 business schools and organizations globally. Welcome, Mary. Sean Hanna is the Tylee Wilson Chair of Business Ethics and a professor of management at the Wake Forest University School of Business. Sean was the founding director of our Legacy Center for Leadership and Character at Wake Forest, and he currently serves in that center as a senior research associate. Welcome, Sean. Carolyn Wu is the former president and CEO of Catholic Relief Services, which is the official humanitarian agency of the U.S. Catholic community. Before taking the helm there, Carolyn was the dean of the Mendoza College of Business at the University of Notre Dame. And welcome, Carolyn. So thank you to our panelists for joining us today. I know we're all looking forward to hearing your thoughts on just a number of topics that reside at the intersection of character and business. And my hope is we can pick up on a couple of themes that came from the keynote speech that directly preceded us. Just a little programming note, in case you missed it, if you were joining us as Ed gave us the introduction, if you're joining us as an audience participant, we will be focusing our conversation today on interaction between our panelists, among our panelists. So the chat function is not enabled currently to allow live questions. But if you do have a thought that you'd like to share with the panel, please do pop it into the Q&A, which I believe should be at the bottom of your screen, and it will absolutely be available to them and can be available to our planners to inform future programming. So thank you in advance for that. So I think that's all the preliminaries. Let's dive right in, shall we? I'd like to start us off by just kind of picking up a train of thought that does come from Dr. Cohen's presentation. She spoke at length about a particular moral character trait, which was guilt proneness. And I'd like to broaden our scope just a bit, but maybe double click on that general idea of moral character traits. And so here's my question to the panel. Interested to hear what character traits or virtues have been particularly important to you in your career, and why have they been important? And we'll allow each of our panelists to respond. I'd like to invite Professor Sean Hanna maybe to lead us off. Sean.
Hey, well, thank you, Michelle. And it's an honor to be here on this esteemed panel today. So I'm really looking forward to engaging with my fellow panelists here. One thing that Michelle didn't tell you is I spent 26 years in the United States Army prior to joining academia. I've been in academia now for about 18 years. And so we're all products, our character, we're products of our environment and our experiences that we've had over our life cycle, particularly during those more formative years. And a lot of the character and the values and the beliefs that I've inculcated are from those earlier experiences in the Army. The seven Army values: loyalty, duty, honor, selfless service, integrity, personal courage, and respect, which, by the way, kind of spells leadership. If you look at the different first letters of each of those words. And, you know, you heard Taya talk a lot about a lot of those attributes too. And so the question is, well, why do we inculcate values? Why do we choose to internalize some values and not others? And the answer is because we find some to be functional. They work. They help us to be successful. They help our organizations to be successful. They allow us to maintain honor and effectiveness and integrity in our organizations and long-term sustainability. So I grew up with these seven Army values, the various combat and contingency operations. And I used to think they were just for soldiers until on 9/11, when the Pentagon got attacked, I was asked to come in and stand back up the organization that had the direct hit, lost 84% of its personnel. And these were all civilians. These were not soldiers. These were Department of the Army accountants and comptrollers and financial managers. And I had no idea where they were going to come back to work the next day after such a horrific incident to happen like that. And when I walked in the next morning, every single survivor was back in the office, ready to stand back up and accomplish the mission. And this organization, as I said, had been devastated, had the largest casualty rates in the Pentagon attack. And I started talking to them and finding out, why are you here? And why are you back so engaged? And everything they talked about related to those same values. They were there under loyalty to support their team members. They knew a lot of their team members would come back. They talked about a sense of duty toward the mission, toward accomplishing the mission. Obviously, a lot about courage to walk back in after an incident like that and pull themselves back up on the horse again and to be able to operate. A lot of them talked about this idea of course, selfless service, that they came back because they had a mission to accomplish. Their focus wasn't just to take care of themselves, but to come back and take care of their teammates, take care of the mission that needed to be accomplished. So it's when we find values and beliefs, and if these are also character strengths when we think about it, things like loyalty and duty, you heard Taya talk about them, it's also strengths of the individual. If we truly take those in and hold them to be important, they start to drive our behavior and they can be inculcated in others. We can hopefully talk about that a little bit more, but that would be pretty much my answer for you, Michelle. So seven Army values. And a lot of those shaped what I do as a scholar. When I came into the scholarly world, I was really surprised there was not a theory about duty. And so some colleagues and I created a theory called duty orientation. We created a theory called moral potency, which has the elements of taking ownership over our moral environment, having confidence to execute morality in that environment, and the courage to stand up and do what's right. And I think the more and more we need to have this conversation and use these kind of words that some people might call kind of quaint more in our business schools and in our businesses. So that I'll yield the floor.
Thank you, Sean. We are off to a great start. And I can say I have the pleasure of working alongside Sean. And I can tell you that his students are very quick to recognize those seven core values as ways that he runs his classroom and ways that he models behavior for his students. So thank you for shaping that up for us. Larry, I wonder if I could ask you to jump in.
Happy to. And thank you again for having me join the group this afternoon. It's good to be back on campus, albeit virtually. You know, I would say that two traits have been important to me on my leadership journey. The first being humility, the second being empathy. And we actually talk a lot about humility at GE. A year ago, in fact, we rolled out our three new leadership behaviors. Humility was one of them. In large part because we were trying to underscore the importance for leaders to feel comfortable, to actually encourage leaders to ask questions as opposed to issue declarations. And that's a little bit of a leadership model shift, but I've just come to believe over a long period of time, leading a range of different businesses, that leaders shape conversations, and they shape conversations by the questions that they ask. And that really sets a tone for an organization that can be very powerful. But beyond asking good questions, right, leaders have to be active listeners with the heartfelt view that you can learn from others, regardless of where they sit in your organization, even if they're three levels down from where you are. And I've just found that as I've been fortunate to have more senior roles over the course of my career, that reality is all the more important to remember and really operationalize, if you will, day in, day out. But I would say related to that, humility is about the idea that no matter how successful you are, no matter how good you or your team are performing, you can always be better, right? And in a lot of organizations, it's hard to admit that, right? That no matter how well a month or a year has gone, there are always opportunities to improve, what the Japanese would call kaizen, right? And to me, that's all wrapped up in humility. And humility is not that far removed from the importance of empathy. And again, it ties, I think, by way of active listening. Whether it's your boss, whether it's a set of peers, whether it's the people that you're responsible for, really having the ability to put yourself in their shoes day in, day out, I just think is incredibly important. It's not always easy. Sometimes people will tell you exactly where they are, and in other times, not so much. But similarly, some of the best new product and commercial leaders that I've ever seen have a wonderful ability to hear what customers say, sometimes hear what customers don't say, and really drive an organization to invest and deliver on innovations with those customer needs in mind, as opposed to what a couple of smart marketers and engineers might have cooked up in their own laboratory. So, I mean, for me, humility and empathy over time have really kind of risen to the top of that list.
Thank you so much for reminding us of just the power of even just human-to-human interaction and how much that can convey in terms of building a culture of character. I'd like to invite Carolyn to jump in at this point.
Thank you very much, Michelle. And to tie in all these different speakers, it really is enlightening. I want to say the values that form my character came from very early. It actually came from growing up in a Chinese family. And we were a post-World War II family. I was born about 10, 12 years after the war, but my older siblings, my parents, relatives, they all came through really difficult times of World War II and then the change in government regime in China. Many of them were refugees. So I grew up in a family where it was always we. There is no I, there's I, but it's the we that matters. I don't even know how old I was, but my father would say, take care of your brothers and sisters. That is always, we have a responsibility to each other. We are family. So from a very early age, there is this sense of responsibility, which drove me in my whole career. It was not the desire for success. It was really, how would I take care of my family? Therefore, I need an education. How would I get my scholarship? It was always a sense about that responsibility. And I think that expanded into is not just responsibility for your family, but for the people who employ you. There's a sense of the organization that relies on you. There is a sense that your colleagues also rely on you. There's a sense that the people you serve, whether they're your students, your patients, and so on, that you also have a responsibility to them. And I think as I grow older, it broadens into what I would call a sense, the capacity for the other. I think Taya talked about guilt-ridden. That's not guilt-ridden, but guilt-prone. But I think there is a sensitivity of your action on other people and feeling that you may have not done your best and that you may have let people down or in some situations actually hurt them. Larry talked about the ability to listen, to be humble, and that is to recognize that other people have something to teach you. I think leadership requires you to develop other people. You have to be for them. if you're not for them, they're not going to come along. So Michelle would say, for me, it's really starting with that sense of responsibility for others, the sense of that I don't prosper if we don't prosper. And in the process, it's the capacity for others. I would say those.
Thank you. Mary, would you like to weigh in at this point?
Yes, thank you. It's a real pleasure and honor to be in this conversation. So when I thought about this question, I don't really think of this in terms of virtue, but I think a core part of my character is something that I call the search for the convergence between the private and the public good. And what I mean by that is, for whatever reason, I always felt sort of a desire to feel that my life mattered. I think there's more and more research now about, you know, what leads to people to move into despair, cynicism, depression, and how people cope with challenges like our whole world is going through right now. And a lot of it has to do with a sense of meaning and being part of some sort of bigger meaning. So I always felt that very acutely. I wanted to serve some sort of public good, some sort of public meaning. But when I was younger, the way I tried to do that was perhaps a little misguided. You know, I would sit down with pieces of paper. I mean, there's many of these in my diaries and journals from younger years, but I'd make lists, you know, what are my skills? What am I capable of doing? And then I'd make another list of what does the world need? You know, and I would try and find the convergence, right? The problem with that is that, of course, we all have certain skills and gifts. And of course, there are many needs in the world and you can find the match. It doesn't mean it's something that you want to do. And so I would find these matches and I'd try and force myself into that, you know, that peg in that hole, which didn't necessarily bring me any satisfaction or happiness. And so at a certain point in my life, I realized that I needed to find the convergence between that public good and the private good. That is what made me happy, what made me feel satisfied. And when I started thinking about it that way, and I think that is part of my character, is looking for that Venn diagram, the place where my happiness, my satisfaction, my sense of accomplishment overlaps with what can be useful and positive and contribute to a wider public good. Finding that overlap is really, I think, what's guided me in my career. And it's been what's led me to the places where I've felt the most successful.
Thank you. If I had to draw a connection between the comments of our panelists here, I think we're getting a strong sense of just the importance of having a sense of something larger than ourselves and feeling a responsibility and an accountability to that larger entity. I'd like to kind of continue in this train of thought, sort of reflecting on your career and what's been important. I know that we have a number of students in our audience today. And so for their benefit, I wonder if each of you could share with us an example, maybe a role model or just an exemplar, someone who has been especially important in shaping your understanding of character, your exercise of character, and how has that example impacted you? So Larry, would love to invite you to the floor first.
Happy to do this. This is, I think, the question where I potentially get kicked out of the conversation, because I'll say something that's maybe inappropriate, given that we not only have a number of Wake Foresters on the podium, but we've got a Wahoo from UVA and Carolyn from Notre Dame. But my dad went to Chapel Hill, the University of North Carolina. So I grew up a big North Carolina basketball fan. And I think one of the most impactful role models for me, frankly, was Coach Dean Smith. I didn't play for Coach Smith. I didn't go to Carolina, but grew up, I think, watching and really admiring a basketball program led by somebody that really, I think, instilled in his team, and I would argue the university, many of the values that Carolyn was speaking to a moment ago, that it was all very much about the team, and the team won or the team lost, despite all the terrific players that went through that program over decades. I don't think I've been disconnected. So thank you. I'll go on for a moment. But so many wonderful lessons. But one that I remember vividly was the custom that Coach Smith would have his players use after they scored a basket. Often when the camera, or at least the crowd's eyes were on the player that it had just scored. And that's when that player would point to the other player on the court who'd passed them the ball, right? To say thank you and to acknowledge that you don't score without somebody out on the court being helpful in that regard. And I think those are the sorts of small but important behaviors that over time really do reinforce these ideas of teamwork, collaboration, being in pursuit of something bigger than yourselves. So while that was a long time ago, those lessons from Coach Smith, I think still influence how I lead today.
Thank you. I do feel maybe responsibility to throw a Go Deeks in here to counter the Carolina example.
Of course.
Thank you. It's very powerful. Sean Hanna, would you like to add to the conversation?
Sure. You know, my research and my just general beliefs are that we don't necessarily have just major role models, but we take little pieces from various role models and anti-role models too, people we don't want to be like. And some of my research is all about moments that matter, trigger events, things that we have these moments that'll stick with you forever and kind of have that indelible, you know, difference on you. And I'll just throw out just a couple of examples. I remember when I went to Ranger School as a young officer. You know, it's an individual school. You don't go through it as a unit. It's all about, are you tough enough to make it through this and good enough to get, you know, get through the other side? And I was an officer when I went through. There's no rank in Ranger School. Everybody's treated the same. And your instructors are mostly sergeants, and they're going to tell you what in the heck to do. And I had this one sergeant who, he just beat up the officers in the course all the time. And, you know, I thought something personal with him. But I'll never forget, on graduation day, he came up to us and he said, "Hey, I want to tell you why I've been so tough on you." And he said, "I haven't been training you to be Rangers. I've been training you to be the type of leader that Rangers will look up to and follow." And from that day forward, I always wore the Ranger tab on my left sleeve. It's on all of our uniforms. And every day I would just remember that sergeant, that kind of a gut check. Am I holding myself to even higher standards than I expect those that follow me to be held to? And I often let that down. You know, I'm not standing up and telling you that I was successful at that, but it would cause me to always ask myself, am I being a role model? Am I leading the way? Am I being the type of leader that other people will want to follow? Just give you one other quick example on the eve of battle in Operation Desert Storm. We had been training for weeks to get the fight started, and we were about ready to launch the main attack force. I was part of the main attack force. We had 150,000 soldiers in one formation ready to move across the Iraqi desert. And we had been thinking about nothing but closing with and destroying the enemy for weeks now, perfecting our craft. And the very last words that our commander said before we took off was, "We may defeat the enemy, but we won't be winners unless we win with honor." And, you know, here in that moment, we're getting ready to unleash the, you know, lethal force of the United States of America on an enemy force. The last word that they wanted us to remember was, "Do it with honor, fight with honor." And, you know, that's just something I think is critical in business. In business, capitalism demands that we fight for the fittest. That's what makes the system work, right? How can I provide the best value? But you've got to win with honor while you're doing it.
Thank you, Sean. Mary, would you like to add a powerful example?
Sure. I agree with what Sean was saying about how there are lots of people that we learn different things from, good and bad, and also that there are these moments that are important. So I want to share a moment and one individual that I think had an important influence on me. The work I do is all around giving voice to values, right? And it grew partly out of my own sense of disempowerment when I was younger. I'm I'm an introvert. I wasn't somebody who saw myself as someone who was going to stand up for what's right, even though I was the kind of person who tended to notice things that I thought weren't right. And so this was a tension for me. And I remember when I first went to work, I worked for 10 years at Harvard Business School. And when I was first there, you know, I was very junior, and I was always in the minority as a woman in whatever setting I happened to be in at the time. I can remember that I stayed silent a lot. You know, I also had come from a non-traditional background. I didn't want to be showing my ignorance or my naivete or just speaking in a way that wasn't, you know, part of the culture. And so I silenced myself a lot. And I remember sitting in a faculty meeting one time. So there's like 80 or 90 faculty in the room. And there was another young junior faculty member there, a woman who also was fairly new. She also came from the South. So she had a pretty heavy Southern accent, which was kind of unusual. I mean, she was probably the only one at the school with that kind of accent. So there were a lot of stereotypes that kind of worked against her a little bit. And I remember that she just would speak up in these meetings, you know, and she would speak in a way that was totally culturally different. It was not just her accent, it was the things that mattered to her, the way she, the lens she used to look at the world. And they were always very important viewpoints. They were sometimes heard and not always heard. But I remember sitting there one day listening to her do this yet again when I was silencing myself and thinking, you know, I kind of have a choice here. I can either ride under the radar and stay quiet and nobody will really know if I fit in or not, but at least they won't know I don't. Or I can just sort of be who I am, as she was doing. And some people will hear it and some people won't, but you know, what world do I want to live in? And that really, it was like a moment for me. You know, we have those moments, as Sean was saying, that matter. And so I would say, Mimi Drumright.
You know, what I love about these stories is that it really reminds us that these people who leave lasting impressions on us, some of them are people that have a particular stature, Dean Smith, but some are just people that we encounter. And so it's a good reminder that we can always be that person to someone else who would be observing us. Carolyn, would you like to bring your story?
Yeah, I have tidbits of stories. In Hong Kong, I was actually educated by American missionaries. So if you folks wonder where do these people go? They came to China, they were expelled, they came to Hong Kong, they were my teachers. I learned two things from them. One was that they were passionate about educating these girls, these little Chinese girls with pigtails and so on. I don't know what they saw in us, but they were passionate. They never had enough money, but that never stopped them. So we participated in a lot of fundraisers. But the first thing I learned from them was that money was not the biggest obstacle if you want something done. The other thing I learned from them, I was in that school for 12 years. Hong Kong was extraordinarily competitive. If you were in a school system in grade 6 and then grade 11 and then grade 12, you have to sit for public exams. And you're graded from A to H. So there was a very, you know, the curve was very punishing. And somehow they created a culture of friendship, of camaraderie. They somehow fostered this sense that we're in this together with the young, all my friends since first grade and some of them kindergarten are still very good friends today. And we were brought up in a very competitive environment. It was elimination. And somehow that always stayed with me. I find sometimes in the US that the competitive spirit really enters into the wrong places. And finally, I worked for the provost of Purdue. I was drafted into the provost's office. I have never done any provost type of work. I was associate provost. And I witnessed how power is used the first time in my life. Look, I mean, I was a professor and then I ran the MBA programs and I graded, I guess, so I can give people C's or D's, but that was not the exercise of power. But in the first time, you know, I see sort of in the provost's office, promotion, denial of tenure, saying yes to various programs, no, allocating resources, and a lot of times saying no. So it was really quite a good demonstration and mentoring to me to see, you know, and of course I was intimidated. I wish not to have to make those decisions as an academic, but it's to learn what are the key values you have to hold when you make decisions with this type of power over the influence of people's life. So I always appreciate it. And what he said was that, what is your North Star going into this? What do you owe the people that you're evaluating? What do you owe the organization which put you in that type of a position? And what do you owe the other people who are the peers of this person? So I just say that was a major sort of formation experience for me.
Thank you. And thank you to each of the panelists for sharing very inspiring stories that I know will stay with me long after the session today. I'd like to continue on with just sort of the theme of developing character muscles. So one way that happens is by observing role models, but let's just kind of broaden things a little bit here. I know we all on the panel have affiliations with universities. And because of that, we think just an awful lot about the educational context in which character can be developed. And this question is going to link to something that came up in the Q&A for Dr. Cohen's presentation. So I'm curious on your thoughts about how character can be educated or improved. And what, as leaders, what is the role of a leader in facilitating this education? Mary, would you like to jump in first?
Sure. So this is kind of what all my work is around, is sort of values-driven leadership development. And it grew, the approach that I think has, that I have developed and that I think is effective for a lot of different reasons, really grows out of something that I think Taya referred to in her Q&A session as well. But it has to do with, she talked about moral motivation, moral ability, and moral identity. And it's really more around moral ability. So this kind of grew out of my frustration with the way when I was working at Harvard Business School and when I was working with companies that trying to develop these skills, the approach tended to be one that was entirely cognitive. It was kind of giving people scenarios and then sharing with them decision-making frameworks and models, lenses, to try and decide what the appropriate thing to do is, what the moral and ethical thing to do is in any particular business situation. I call it the preach and pretend method, because it was kind of like we preach about what's right and then we pretended that people could do it. And what I saw so often is that, of course, there are always some bad actors, but that what I saw both with the business practitioners I worked with and with the MBA students that I worked with, was that a lot of them really kind of knew when something was wrong, you know, some of the obvious things, not the more subtle, really, really gray areas, but a lot of the things that actually get us into major scandals, they kind of knew, but they actually just, and they didn't necessarily want to do it, but they didn't feel that there was a choice. So that was sort of the observation. And I felt in a way, the way we were teaching this was almost a schooling for sophistry, because I would sit in these classroom discussions and people would learn, you know, utilitarianism and deontology and virtue-based ethics. And they'd look at a scenario and there were many ways that you could frame it from those different angles. That's good for disciplining your thinking, but it doesn't necessarily tell you how to act. I remember interviewing a CEO who told me that he had been interviewing a recent MBA grad from a top business school, who told him that in his ethics class, he learned all the models of ethical reasoning. And then he learned when you encounter a values conflict, you should decide what you want to do and then select the model of ethical reasoning that will best support what you want to do. Now that's not exactly what the professor had in mind. And so when I started to see that and feel that frustration, and also started to recognize more and more research from neurosciences and behavioral ethics and social psychology that suggested that if you really want to have an impact on people's behavior, that rehearsal, pre-scripting, practice, and peer coaching are much more effective ways of doing so. And so the approach that I take and the approach that I've seen a lot of impact with is actually what we call post-decision making. We give people scenarios where the right answer, the ethical answer, the answer you would like to promote in your organization as a responsible leader is in the scenario. And the question is, how could you get that done? What would you need to say? What would the pressures be? How would you address them? And it triggers a different kind of thinking. You know, it triggers the innovation and the creativity. And it also gives people that opportunity to practice that. So even people who maybe don't come in with that higher guilt proneness, as Taya referred to it, or sense of interpersonal responsibility, as I think Carolyn referred to it, even if they don't come in with that, they're given the opportunity to work with peers who are the same kinds of people they would work with in these organizations to craft a strategy, a script, an action plan that is likely to be successful. So that's how I think about that.
Thank you. I believe Carolyn also has a project at her university that she would like to tell us a bit about.
Yes. So by the way, Mary's work on giving voice to values is really a must in training people how to speak their truth. I want to say, first of all, I'm going to make a statement. I think to think that we need to teach people right from wrong and that they don't know right from wrong is wrong-headed thinking. There's a lot of research that shows that if nothing is on the line, if you ask, you know, is truth telling right? Yes. Is lying wrong? Yes. Is whatever, that across the board, very, very robust findings that say people know what is right from what is wrong. So the issues that we face in ethical misbehavior, I think, is not that people do not know what is right from wrong, but they do not do what they know to be right. Knowing does not lead to doing. That's the biggest issue. So we approach it in two levels. One is at the level of personal formation. The other, of course, is you have a later question of what do professional ethicists in companies or whatever, how do they approach this? But I want to talk about the person. So we have this experience, we call it the character project. Is not a course, is not an ethics course, but it's about character, which is the alignment of what you believe in, what you say you are, and how you really behave. It is a spring course. We only take 24 students, half female, half male. They tend to be juniors and seniors. Before they go away for the Christmas vacation, we give them a survey. It's over 100 questions. And it's really sort of for them to think about how they would act in different situations. They have a lot of time to think about it. They therefore take it seriously. We invite them to draw in other people to give comment about how they would do. But it's choices like, you know, oh, if you have to break up with someone, do you just stay away? Or do you text the person? Do you ask to meet in person? How do you want to manage that? Under what conditions would it be good to renege? on a former plan, you know, people make plans on Monday and they say, be sure to save a seat on Uber for me. But then on Thursday, they say, oh, I have this big paper due. I'm sorry, can't join you Friday. But that's because they found something better to do. So there are a lot of these situations in the daily life of students and some broader questions. And so we start with, well, how would you do this? Do you want to tell the truth? Yes. If you have a friend who has a major sort of misbehavior problem, how would you approach this? They would say, well, gingerly, and never tell the truth and say, this is not good for your health or something like this. So we start with that. They come back with their answers and we really use a chain, which is to say, the way you make decisions reflect your values, right? When you say, it's okay to stand up someone or change my plans, when, you know, the newer plans are so much more exciting. If I had known it was coming, I wouldn't have done this or whatever. What does it say about you your priorities, your preferences, what is important to you. So we take the decisions and then we go back to values. We say your values drive your decisions and you have to be honest about your values. Your decisions will drive your actions. Repeated actions will develop into habit. Taya talked about habit. Good habits become virtues, bad habits become vices, and it defines your character. So we take them through and we, you know, at a certain point, they think about their habits and so on. But then we stopped there and then we said, in order to really have your character, you have to reclaim, who do you want to be? Who do you want to be at your best? You know, and what they would tell you is that, well, at my best, I want to be this. And we'll say, where did that come from? Where does this vision come from about you at your best? And it would come from scriptures. I mean, Notre Dame is a Catholic school. 85% of the kids are Catholic. And then the other thing is they would say, my grandmother thinks that I'm just a really class act. My third grade teacher, Sister Mary, who had catechism, think that I am just the best kid. So it also recovers how important parents are, the people who bring these young people up to give them a sense of who they are. So they start with there and then they say, how do I close the gap? And I just want to use, so, and then at the end, there's a lot of readings, but there's a project. The last project was for them to reflect on where there was a gap in who they like to believe they are and how they acted and that there was this misalignment and how they would deal with it. So we did this for 5 years, 24 with lots of papers. But that one that stuck in my mind was a kid who said, I applied to medical school. I'm a good student and I want to be a doctor. They all asked me, why do I want to be a doctor? And he said, well, the standard line you have to say because you want to serve other people. He said, well, I do want to serve them, but I just want a high paying profession. You know, I didn't come from money. I just want a profession where I could make money. That was my approach. But I, you know, of course, what you should say is you want to cure people. And he said, I didn't get all the acceptances. He did get some. He said, my grades, my scores, test scores would stand me in like the top 3% of applicants, but I didn't get all the applicants at all the schools. And he said, perhaps they sensed that I was insincere. Perhaps they sensed that I was just giving them a line. And he said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to postpone entering medical school by 1 year, and I'm going to go join a service operation just so that now I could stand behind my word and that I wanted to do service. Now, this is kind of a funny way of, you know, of changing it, but it was the first step and say, I am going to make good on something I said about myself, which was a throwaway line. And now for my own sake, I want to make it true. So that's a character project.
Thank you. Sean, I believe you are unmuted. Would you like to jump in next?
Sure. And, you know, actually, I'd like to build on what Carol and Mary just talked about. I agree with Mary. I think way too many business schools, for example, spend too much time in business ethics classes talking about ethical decision making and how do you make the optimum decision when, you know, Larry, I'm sure, is probably the most equipped of all of us to talk about. That's hard to do, especially when you're a senior leader in a company where you're not dealing with necessarily just right versus wrong issues. Those are the easy ones. You know, those are the ones you know what's right. That's just an issue of do I have the courage and the sense of ownership and things like that to do what's right. What's tough is the right versus right decisions. You know, is it right to take profits from the company and improve the benefits and well-being of our workforce? Absolutely. But is it also right to take those same dollars and put them toward corporate social responsibility or limiting our carbon footprint on the world? Yes, that is. Is it also right to return value to shareholders? Yes, it is, right? It's these competitions between right versus right issues that are the tough ones. And some of that does have to do with ethical decision-making, but even more so, it's about who do I want to be and who do we want to be as a firm? What kind of culture do we want to have? What kind of, you know, sense of character do we want to have as a bigger organization? And, you know, to Carolyn's point, scholars call this the judgment action gap, where when we make a judgment, the correlation between making an ethical decision or judgment and actually behaving in line with that judgment has been found to be only about 0.20. Now, what that means is the vast majority of the time we make decisions and say things like, oh, they shouldn't do that, or somebody ought to do something about that, you know, but us taking the stand to say, I should do something about that, and then act in line with our beliefs, that's where the real magic happens. And that's where I think particularly in business schools, we need to throw more of the tough, hairy problems at our students and help them to think through these right versus right and wrong versus wrong. Sometimes we have to create harm, and the question is to whom, and how are we going to manage that decision-making? Wrestling with those tough ones and then tie it all back to our character again of what we want to be is so critically important. And I think, and this is one thing I think we really do well in the School of Business here at Wake Forest. I also think these decisions have to be integrated with the functional aspects of business. So here in Wake Forest, we have the Center for Leadership and Character that's actually called within the school a proponent responsible for integrating ethics and leadership across the entire curriculum. And that's where the magic happens. The marketing classes should be teaching marketing and, oh, by the way, immersing it to a certain extent in these aspects of ethics and character and value and what is it to be an effective leader. Same thing in finance, same thing in strategy and all the other functional areas, so that as people are thinking through business problems, they're integrating character and ethics into those business problems as just part of the decision criteria, along with the business viability of a decision and all of that. But I just think we spend too much time, not only in business schools, but in business, focusing on what I would call moral obligation versus moral aspiration. If you look at almost any code of conduct for almost any business, it's about what you should do and not do, very behaviorally. A lot less about who we should be. And instead of worrying about, hey, let's make sure that our employees stay above the moral floor, you know, they don't do anything wrong and they do the minimum of what needs to be done, the question is, how can we try to get a culture where people want to aspire toward the moral ceiling? That idea of moral aspirations, you're guided on principles and beliefs and ideals and not a set of behaviors that one feels that I need to do and not do, the oughts and the ought nots. And anyways, I just think that having that broader, richer conversation is really critical. And the last thing that I would just say is, going back to my earlier point, that we internalize character and values and beliefs because we find them functional. I can't just give somebody a list of values and say, hey, these are the corporate values, so you need to live by them. I need to be able to sit that person down and say, why do we have these values? And why are these and not others? What was the inclusion-exclusion criteria? Why did we say these are the most important things that we need to be, know, and do in this organization? And then make sure that we operationalize them. I think Larry used that term earlier. You know, put them in operation. So we'd say something like respect. Okay, what does that even mean? And what does that look like? If I'm on the plant floor in Picatinny on the assembly line, what does respect mean to me? What does it look like in behaviors and actions and decisions? And if we don't operationalize and drill that down and apply these vague words, we're really doing a disservice for our organizations. So with that, I'll yield.
Thank you. And that feels like it's a great setup to some comments from Larry.
Well, I would just say, as a first principle, leaders really need to decide whether this conversation is optional or fundamental to the sort of culture that they're trying to create, the team they want with them in pursuit of the mission. And I know plenty of leaders who are quite eloquent on the topic, but to borrow from Carolyn, who probably aren't all that sincere, right? Either in their boardroom or on that shop floor that Sean just referenced. But the leaders that I've come to really respect over time really have made these sorts of behaviors fundamental to the way they lead and the type of companies that they're trying to build. But to just expand a little bit on what it means to operationalize, at least at GE today, we try to talk about our leadership behaviors at every turn. Hopefully our leaders are modeling those behaviors in every possible situation. And we take great pains to both reward and frankly punish behaviors that are either in sync or at odds with those leadership behaviors. I mentioned earlier, we recast our leadership behaviors, a short list of three a year ago: humility, transparency, and focus. I won't bore you with all the details, but that's been a rallying cry for a senior team and frankly a board at a time in the company's history where some might say, why are you even bothering? There's so much else that you need to tend to. Why would you talk about values, leadership behaviors? Why would you talk about culture? And I can even see it in the eyes of investors. They're investors whose eyes just glaze over when we get into that part of the GE story today. But then there's other investors who really understand that this is part of a long-term transformation of the company. You talk about modeling this behavior. I remember very vividly early on, I was with one of our businesses. We had just won a big contract, cause for celebration. I quite innocently asked, well, what happens next? Not knowing that I had walked into a situation where the customer gave us a big contract award, but our first meeting with them couldn't have gone worse. And that was probably more our doing than theirs. The person who got the question three levels down from me just was clearly mortified that this was on the table. I could look around the room and there were others more senior than him that I think were similarly uncomfortable. To his credit, he told me exactly what happened, that it had not been a good meeting. It was one of those moments where you are tested, right? Do you overreact or take that as an opportunity to do a little bit of problem solving, to do a little bit of teaching? We took the latter course. You could see everyone's blood pressure come down. It was a wonderful moment to try to model the behavior that we want to have be part of our culture going forward. And we've also taken great pains in our performance evaluation framework, not only to recognize what people do, but how they do it. Now, some of that is rooted in process, but frankly, the how is also very much rooted in the values and the behaviors that, again, we want to reward or frankly, we need to punish. So that's the way we're going about it, but it never happens quickly, right? This is the ultimate long march relative to organizational or cultural change in my book, but also the most important one at the end of the day.
Thank you. Definitely. I think a theme running through a lot of the comments today is just the importance of thinking of this as the long game and as a process that never really completes and that we're all continually working toward. I do have one eye on the clock here. And so I think we have time for one last question. You can believe it. We're almost already at time. I knew this would fly by. The last thing I would put to the panel is I'd like to invite us all to just look into the crystal ball a little bit. And kind of as you look into the future of the profession of business, what ethical issues do you see as being particularly prominent in, let's say, the next 5 years? So we can take that in a number of directions. Sean, would you like to lead us off?
Sure. I think Larry's probably the most equipped to speak to that, but I'll give it my best college try to kick off. I think, you know, Taya talked a lot about short-termism as being a major issue, and I would echo that. I think particularly in today's information technology environment and the transparency that businesses have to operate under, people are much more able to quickly see what you're doing, scrutinize what you're doing, and agree or disagree with what you're doing. And, you know, we've got activist investors, and there's just a lot more activity happening now that are making sometimes you wonder who's wagging the dog, right? Or the tail here. And the short-termism, of course, then leads to a lot of possible dysfunctional behaviors, not only the misplacement of capital investments and things for the long-term success of the organization, but also it lends itself toward expediency and maybe some unethical behavior to meet nearer term objectives. But I think a much larger and bigger issue is with a lot of the social movements going on now, the roles and responsibilities of business. And what are those? Because every institution is now being challenged. And the question becomes, what is the purpose of business? And if we don't get down and have those deeper conversations about that. It's very difficult for leaders to then understand, how should I lead a business? I first need to know, what should it be? And one of the issues that I get very concerned about is an issue of fear. You know, you ask what ethical issues, I would say fear of many businesses to truly be authentic and say what they really believe in and what they don't believe in. And that's one of the issues. If we ask ourselves, what is culture? All scholars of culture will define it something like, it's the shared truths and assumptions of a collective and their formulation of shared values and beliefs. So by definition, culture has that word shared in it. And so when we say we have a culture, whether it's a national culture or a culture in a business or whatever, what we're saying is there are a set of things that we share that we believe in. And as soon as we say that, we're drawing a circle. And there are things inside that circle, and there are things outside that circle. And it's a very difficult conversation today to have in today's world, because if anybody finds themselves or their group or their ideals or their beliefs outside the circle, well, obviously then the person who draw the circle comes under great scrutiny and public, you know, we all know what's going on. So the question becomes, a business leader has to decide, are we going to have a culture? That's really, it's a very fundamental question. And if we are, we have to be willing to stand up and draw a circle and say, these are the things we believe in around here, and that there are things outside the circle. And I think that that's one of the greatest challenges now, is that definition. And then, you know, this conversation around, again, what is the roles of business? What's the roles of capitalism? And how do we approach that in a way that is going to sustain not only business, but society into the future? So I'll kind of stop there and yield the floor to others.
Big questions that we've introduced with 3 minutes to go. Larry, I wonder if you have a thought or two you'd like to add.
Yeah, I would just build on that. At GE, we talk about the three Ds in terms of the mega trends over the next generation or two that will shape both the opportunities and the challenges facing our business. Digitalization, decarbonization, and certainly the decoupling, not just US-China, but really the way the world is likely to fragment in different ways over time. In each of those three spheres, there are gonna be important trade-offs that Sean referenced earlier, let alone cross currents amongst those three areas. And that's not just a GE dynamic in my view, that's literally going to come ashore in every business. And how we go about decision-making with respect to priorities, with respect to resource allocation, I think we'll just be chock full of challenge and intrigue for business leaders going forward. And the types of topics we talked about today, I think, are going to be central to navigating those trends successfully.
Thank you, Larry. Carolyn, do you have a couple of thoughts to add?
Yeah, I see two major trends. But before I say that, I think Larry mentioned something I want to echo. When you talk about how do students really learn, I think students learn from looking at our behavior. They also learn from being the recipient of how we treat them. I think Sharon Parks did a very good job to say, you know, the university is a very important mentoring environment to young people. It's the first time they engage an environment on their own as adults. So I just want to say that, because I think a lot of times universities focus on courses and centers and research and speakers, but the university needs to focus on itself as really sort of the first teacher of how values are put into action in the way they engage as students. I'll be quick on my two big trends. I think that ESG, where companies always said they're doing something, now has a different level of seriousness and integration into the business strategy. If you are not engaged on a social level in terms of the, not just responsibility, but to have the legitimacy and the right of way, a different social contract that people are looking for, you know, in the management of jobs, for example, and benefits and well-being of employees, and of course, environment. I think that's a very big trend. It's no longer a marginal undertaking. It has to be an integrative undertaking. The second point is the call for accountability is at a completely different level. And so the particularly the E part of it, there are all these new metrics, new frameworks using AI and the amount of data and AI and so on to start really calling firms, companies accountability. And internally, the relationship between the company and the employees is also because of social media and you know, the access to information. So this whole area of transparency, accountability in particular, is at a different level. So much more is expected of companies in terms of how it internalized the ES, and the G part has already taken place. So greater responsibility and much greater monitoring.
Thank you, Mary.
Well, so I kind of want to build on what Carolyn was just saying. I mean, Sean and Larry and Carolyn have all identified huge trends that are important, right? I mean, equity and inclusion, digitalization, sustainability, climate change, you know, all of these kinds of issues. But I want to take a step behind those and to say that I think what we're really facing is what I'm calling crisis of truth. You know, where in order to address any of those issues, short-termism even, you know, when you talk about how you value or measure the value of the firm, I think behind all of those is a sense that right now we don't have a common language, agreed upon metrics, agreed upon priorities, and even just agreed upon facts, you know, and I put that in quotes, to be able to talk about and resolve any of those issues that we've been naming. And so when I look at the responsibility of business, of everyone, but including business, because they're such a powerful actor in the face of that crisis of transparency, I mean, that crisis of truth, is transparency. And when I say transparency, I mean it in terms of about the data we're using, about the sources of the data we're using, about the metrics we're using, about our own motivations for using and choosing that data and those metrics, about what we see as the limitations of that data and those sources, so that we're not all going to come to the same conclusions about what the right thing to do is, but we do need to have some sort of beginning of a conversation about what to believe in order to begin to make those decisions. And so I would say transparency in that broadest sense.
And it kind of gets back to Sean's point about who do we want to be? And that then shapes the definitions that I think you're calling for, Mary. Well, I think at this point, we are going to move toward a wrap up. This has been a very, very rich hour of conversation, as I knew it would be. I would really like to thank our distinguished panelists, Larry, Mary, Sean, Carolyn. Thank you for sharing your perspectives, your rich experience with us today. You've given all of us a lot to think about as we each strive in our own way to be leaders of character. And we're just grateful for your insights. I'd also like to thank our audience participants for choosing to spend part of a sunny, I hope, in your neck of the woods Saturday afternoon with us. And I hope that you have found in this last hour some ideas, some thoughts, some key moments maybe that sort of give you a new way of thinking or a way of expanding your thinking around the critical importance of leading with character. So with that, I will thank you all. And I believe Ed will take it from here. Thank you, Ed.
Well, that was a terrific, a rich hour indeed. Thanks to you, Professor Rehm, and to our panelists for a wonderful conversation on the role of character in business.